We sh maybe we shouldn't reveal that about ourselves. People are like, these guys are creepy. Watch a lot of horror into serial killers. They probably eat people.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Richard Wally, you are my co-host, and you live in the state of Oregon.
Oh, and you, Cassidy Robinson, live in the state of California.
But somehow we managed to do this anyway.
With that whole technology baloney.
Mm-hmm. If this was like the 1930s or something, we'd have to do a podcast via like horse message carrier.
A tin can, really long string.
Very long string.
Yes.
And the delay would be more than like 0.5 seconds that Skype gives us. It would be like 40 day delay.
This is a weird conversation. I don't know where we're
this
going.
This is. I don't either. Do you want to just keep going down this rabbit hole and see where it takes us? I'm sure it'll go to time travel eventually.
Yeah. It'll eventually end up there, like right. Clones or something.
Do you know that they say that any argument, if taken far enough, someone will compare the other person to Hitler? I think
you're Hitler.
Right, well, you too. And me of you, obviously.
Somebody had to say it first, and I wanted to be the first one to say it.
Right. But I think any kind of nonsensical conversation will eventually lead to time travel. Whether you're high or sober or just really tired.
What about time displacement? That's not the same thing.
Is it not? I think that's close enough.
It's not the same thing. Time dilation is not the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Today we're going to be reviewing Exodus, Gods and Kings. And in our Netflix homework, we will be reviewing The Source Family. What have you done anything interesting, anything fun?
Are you just kind of train ride?
You went on a train ride.
A choo-choo train ride, yeah.
Choo-choo, even.
It's a big steam engine. It was a holiday kind of. It drove down this little parkway place, and we got to see the city lights at night. And yeah, it was a fun little Christmas excursion thingy.
Right. What is the Portland Christmas experience? Because here, obviously, it's still like, 65 degrees outside. And that's probably as cold as it's going to get all year.
It gets chillier, but it's like a wet, humid cold, and it's...
Right.
I don't know. I mean, it's people say, actually, a lot of people say Merry Christmas around here.
They do?
Yeah.
They don't say.
I figured this would be a
happy non-denominational winter holiday.
Yeah, that's how you'd feel, but like, no, not really. Actually, a lot of people are pretty into it around here too.
Yeah. So they're really into like the sweaters and the lights and doing the whole thing.
Randomly, yes. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The lights. Nothing in my neighborhood, but when you go to some of, but we saw quite a few yesterday driving around. So.
Right.
We apparently live in the humbug neighborhood, but...
The what?
The humbug neighborhood.
Oh, okay. So nobody's doing anything fun around where you live?
No.
My neighbors across the way have a pretty big setup going on. I mean, I'm very suburban. I mean, I live, like, pretty much right in downtown Anaheim.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a lot of lights and, of course, the obligatory, skeletal... reindeer thingies. I don't know what you call those.
Yeah, I don't like those.
You're against those?
They look fine from far away, but then as soon as you get close up, it's like, these are really weird, actually.
Why are they weird?
They're just, like you said, they're like these skeletal, like, like, I mean, they're just these white wrapped things. They're like weird ethereal ghost reindeer things, and they're not even really like appropriate sized, and it's just, there's a lot wrong with them.
Yeah, you notice how like Christmas decorations go through trends, like everything obviously, but like, you know, a few years ago it was the reindeer, then like a few years before that everyone discovered sickle lighting and, yeah, and started doing sickle lights everywhere, and some people keep those up like all year, and then like I think just recently it's giant inflatable shit that has like a light in the center of it.
It seems like that's been like a couple years. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's not just Christmas either, like I see a lot of Halloween and a lot of just, I guess, Halloween and Christmas.
Right, and that's pretty gaudy. I have to say, the giant inflatable, like, snowman with a light inside of it, or Santa or whatever, that's like the face tattoo of lawn decorations.
Yeah, I don't like them.
Well, let's go ahead and get into the movie news. I have my first story here.
Mm-hmm.
Blindside director is tackling...
Your favorite.
My favorite guy, John Lee Hancock, is tackling the story of McDonald's. It's supposed to be kind of like a Social Network-esque tell-all,
mm-hmm,
of like how basically this farmer was ripped off by corporate America and, you know, turned it into a big giant franchise that it is today. So it's a story that needs to happen. It needs to be told.
Maybe. Might be interesting. I mean, when you said it like that, I was like, oh, okay. I mean, if it was going to be like a positive, like, McDonald's can save children.
That's the subtitle. the story of McDonald's. McDonald's can save children. How meta would it be if McDonald's did movie tie-in Happy Meal toys for their own movie?
That would be weird and awkward. It would be too meta. I don't know.
Little plastic figurine of a CEO businessman.
Like the Lego and all those guys. They go with the appropriate amount of meta.
Yeah.
But then lately I've been seeing this pop up of this like super meta. Mm-hmm. I'm not okay with it. It's just weird. Not funny. It's not even that clever.
Right.
I don't like it. So no, I don't want that to happen. McDonald's, listen to me.
Well, now they'll do it just because you're saying not to.
Yeah.
The article that I'm reading from here at the Hollywood Reporter says that the tone of the script has been described as being akin to The Social Network and There Will Be Blood. So do with that whatever you will. I don't know. I'm not into The Blind Side. I thought that was a pretty much terrible movie.
Did you see it?
I mean,
did you see it?
To be fair,
caught you, motherfucker.
I watched it in the store, the video store I was working in, because my everyone I worked with pretty much loved it, and they would play on loop every once in a while, depending on who I was working with and how much I was allowed to protest. So, yeah, maybe I haven't given it the full college try as far as, like, sitting in front of it and really, like, taking in the movie. But pretty much everything about it I don't like. And I'm not sure about his tone, if he can pull off a Social Network, There Will Be Blood kind of thing. But, you know, I really have nothing really to judge him on. And if the screenplay is good enough, and they do really plan on telling the story honestly... And not even just necessarily negatively, but honestly, it could have a lot to say about sort of, you know, the corporate oligarchy that has taken over the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there's an interesting story there and an interesting subject matter for sure.
The last movie Hancock directed was Saving Mr. Banks. So he none of his movies have really come out. Like, these are all kind of crowd pleasers.
Yeah, you know? And Saving Mr. Banks wasn't bad. It was cute.
I know some people. There are people out there who hate that movie almost more than they hate The Blind Side.
You?
I've never seen it. I wasn't as against the idea of Saving Mr. Banks as I was The Blind Side, but yeah, I never saw it, so I can't say.
It wasn't, I don't know. I mean, it was fine. Right. It was kind of utterly forgettable, I think, but not really. I still remember it, I guess, but
it didn't do a lot for you.
No, it was just like, it's cute.
Right.
I was fine for 2 hours. I probably don't have a lot of reason to go back, but
what's the first story you have?
Well, as always, I'm pretty interested that Darren Aronofsky guy.
Right.
If you've heard of him.
I have.
He may be attached to a film about a serial killer called The Good Nurse.
A real serial killer or fictional?
Real.
Oh.
A for realsy serial killer. It's the serial killer was a nurse who everybody loved him. I mean he received accolades like for being a good medical person. And then several years later, two detectives basically found out that he'd murdered somewhere around 200 people.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people, yeah.
Even for a serial killer, that's like way up there. Was this like in the 20th century, 21st century?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I believe it was I have to look it up now. It's going to drive me crazy if I don't. He was arrested in 2003.
Wow. Was he American?
I believe so, yes.
Why have we never heard about this?
It was in New Jersey. because, okay, so he was implicated in the deaths of as many as 300 patients. It's hard to tell because, I mean, people die in hospitals, you know.
Right.
And, I mean, it is a really good way to hide killing people if you're like, oh, this guy died. Oops. specifically, well, what's funny is actually a lot of the popular, I guess, serial killers are still your guys from like the 70s and
80s.
It was made a much bigger deal and much more sensationalized then, I guess.
Yeah.
And now they don't really do that because there was a guy, not too long ago that they caught in Alaska, and I mean, he'd killed quite a few people too. So, I mean, right. It still happens. Like, it's not like this like thing that, just happened in the 70s and 80s. And
well, the media doesn't want to necessarily acknowledge it anymore by turning, you know, these people into kind of pseudo celebrities. And like, I get it. Well, like, it's probably better that they're not. But that is just so many humans.
That is a lot of humans. Yes.
like usually, like, you know, if a serial killer is, you know, 10 to 20 is a lot.
Well, I mean, yeah. And even if you're getting up into the higher numbers, like, I mean,
yeah,
you take a Green River killer and that's like in your 60s. I mean, yeah, no, 300 is like ridiculous amount.
Yeah.
But so,
but yeah, Darren Aronofsky.
Yeah, that's, no, Darren Aronofsky. He's a good director. I'd watch the shit out of a movie about him doing it about a serial killer.
Right.
Probably have an interesting angle. It probably wouldn't actually be about him, like, you know, stabbing people to death in the hallway. But maybe. You never know.
Yeah. I mean, Darren Aronofsky, he definitely has...
I hope there's rock monsters in it.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully there's that. He definitely has sort of an edgy persona as a director. He's oftentimes sort of drawn to sensational material, stuff that is, you know, he can kind of draw a lot of melodrama from. I would say he's kind of an unabashedly melodramatic director. He just, kind of in a very classical sense, really sort of enjoys, you know, turning the screws and fucking with people, with his movies. And some people don't like that about his movies, and some people enjoy that quite a bit. Generally, more often than not, enjoy it quite a bit. So I could see, like, you know, I love Black Swan, and I thought it was still one of my favorite movies of that year, even though some people have said that it's just, you know, schlock, or that it's overly simplistic, or blah, blah, blah. I think him going in this direction, you know, kind of makes perfect sense.
I mean, I like a lot of his darker work. The only thing I haven't been overly fond of his is The Fountain, but...
Yeah, me either. But again, I saw that.
I need to go back to it. It's still weird. It's a weird film. And I mean, just some weird films you need to go back to just kind of be like, okay, now that I know the weirdness is there, let's get a better grounding.
Right.
But, I mean, and he's, you know, Black Swan for me, it was a lot in his aesthetics and a lot in his, yeah, you know, just the atmosphere.
There is going to be an O.J. Simpson movie, possibly, called American Crime Story, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. And I'm judging from the title, it's probably more about the case than the killing or the, or his, you know, football stardom or whatever. And Cuba Gooding Jr. might play him.
It's just a might.
Yeah. I mean, I guess so, yeah.
Okay. Well.
Oh, no. Well, the article says is playing, so. And Ryan Murphy, speaking of unabashedly melodramatic, sensational people, of Nip Tuck and Glee fame, is going to direct.
Yeah, I don't. Has he done any film?
Yeah, he did The Normal Heart that was premiered on HBO. He did Eat, Pray, Love. He also directs, or not directs, but he's a showrunner for American Horror Story.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Nip Tuck. That's
right. That Ryan Murphy.
It depends on which. I mean, what direction he goes in. Mm-hmm. I mean, he can be real. He can go real lowbrow.
Yeah.
I mean, almost the entertaining kind of lowbrow.
Mm-hmm.
Or I've seen him hit like really really high notes. So it's I. So this this is kind of interesting material for him. So I don't know how to think about it. It's like, where is he going with this?
Right.
Is it going to be like a family movie, or is this going to be?
I don't think so. Judging from just from what it's about, I'm going to say probably not.
You don't know.
Cuba Gooding Jr. playing OJ is not the worst thing I've ever heard. I don't think of him as a really big, broad shouldered dude though, like OJ is. Movie magic, I guess you can do that. But remember, like, his the whole thing about him, his character in the Jerry Maguire movie, it was that he was like too small, and so that's why he couldn't get all the like great Nike deals and stuff. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like he's slowly but surely kind of working his way back up the ladder.
Well, he's one of those guys too, though, I think can bring it.
Yeah, totally.
Like, he just, people don't give him those roles because maybe they don't exist. I don't know. I think this could be an interesting subject matter. Maybe now we're far enough away you could actually say something about it without it, you know? I mean, some directors can just be in the moment, but... Mm-hmm. I don't know. That was a pretty... Unless you were John Waters. I want John Waters to do this movie. That's what I've decided right now.
Oh, my. All right. let's get into the pet topic. The biggest news story probably that came out in the last couple weeks. We covered it a little bit in the last episode. Or one of the last episodes. I don't remember. Is this whole deal with the Sony leak. The Guardians of Peace, as they're calling themselves... which may or may not have ties to North Korea, although the more we learn about it, the more likely that probably is, since they seem to be very against the release of The Interview, the Seth Rogen movie. And before, they were just kind of releasing screeners and kind of fucking around with people. Now, they are getting more and more into the actual personal information of all the people who work at Sony, both studio executives, writers, actors, releasing how much people are getting paid for things, releasing emails, more specifically, that are throwing a lot of foots in a lot of people's mouths at the moment.
They're also doing medical records.
Records, yeah, getting very much into personal information. And they claim, you know, that in this movie is released, that, you know, these... It's going to get worse and worse for the studio executives. So I guess my question is, there's been all these crazy gossipy emails that have come out. And, you know, we have Aaron Sorkin talking about how he, you know, doesn't want Michael Fassbender in the Steve Jobs movie. And we have Amy Pascal saying quote-unquote racially insensitive things about the president, and there's all this stuff that's kind of coming out, all this kind of juiciness, if you will. And I guess, do you think that this kind of transparency, it's not like we didn't already kind of know that this is what happens and this is what goes on, but do you think that this sort of transparency is a good thing or a bad thing? Do you think it's better that we just blow the lid off the whole thing and just let everyone kind of start from ground zero? Or do you think that there's a certain amount of secrecy that should be allowed within the industry when sending emails back and forth? So-and-so should be able to slag off so-and-so without it ever coming back on them.
Like, this is just straight up kind of a really super bitchy move. Like, all this is basically, like, super censorship and bully. Like, that's what the move is to me. I don't think it's very... At first I was kind of like, okay, you know, this is kind of cool, we get to kind of see, and then I was kind of like, no, this is really messed up. I mean...
Yeah.
I mean, it's just kind of, it's very similar to getting your nudie photos released. You know,
yeah, that's kind of how the media's sort of taken the story now. Now that there's so much come out, there's a certain amount of people, you know, Seth Rogen and a few others who have said, why are you guys sharing this information that was stolen? This wasn't, you know, studio industry buzz. This was, you know, released against our will. And people are kind of talking about it in those terms, like the Fappening that happened earlier this year.
The what?
The Fappening, the big nudie photo iPhone leak.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was the term for it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I have a hard time not looking at it like that because, I don't know, maybe I've been an asshole before in my life, so I can kind of like just be like, you know... There are just, like, personal, you know, private conversations between two people. And you might say something offhanded and not mean it in that context even, or even really mean anything by it.
Yeah.
And if it was reported in a certain way and people wanted to look at it that way, they could. And so, I mean, I guess I kind of feel for them. Even if they are saying bad things or hurtful things, it's still like, you know, I've had coworkers I've really liked, but, you know, at one point I've bitched about them because they sucked at their job or whatever. So, I mean, it's... And, you know, not everything needs to be transparent like that. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think I'm mostly against...
You're against knowing what there is out there.
Yeah, and I don't think that, you know, or just like, I mean, one of the news articles we didn't end up doing... But we could kind of talk about that is like, you know, it was released that Sony has the Mario Brothers, the rights to those.
Right.
That property to develop that as a film. And it's kind of like, okay.
I mean, I feel like.
But there's nothing attached to it. Like.
Right. I think that story just isn't really ripe enough to really be released as acquisition. Like, you know, at this point, I don't think that they are embarrassed about that kind of stuff going out there. I feel like that would come out on its own anyway. I'm talking more specifically this kind of confidential industry bickering that's kind of happening behind the curtain. And I mean, there's an interesting interview out there right now with Lisa Kudrow, where she pretty much come out and said, you know, since I've been a celebrity, I don't have an opinion anymore. Like, I don't say those kind of things in emails because I know that, you know, it can't, once you've documented it somewhere, it can come back at you. So if you're going to be working in this industry, you need to have tact and you need to, you know, comport yourself in a professional manner. And she, you know, it's, I guess if we are comparing it to the nudie leak thing, it's the, would you see that as that kind of rationale as the basically the same as, well, why were you taking those photos in the first place?
A little, yeah. I mean, it's your private email. They're not releasing, like, this wasn't like something that, you know, or like the whole thing she said about Angelina Jolie. It wasn't like she was saying these to these people. It was an offhanded comment to some, you know, somebody she was kind of close or personal with. And it's kind of like, you know, this is, and it's the intention behind it. This is meant to hurt and destroy. This is a bullying tactic because somebody can't take a joke.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying it's a good or it's in good taste. I'm not even commenting on that at all. I'm just commenting on what is exactly happening. And I can't, that's where, I mean, the argument goes back to for me. Like, I know I've brought it up, but that's, for me, that's the bottom line of the whole thing.
Right. Do you, okay, so, like, personally, I never looked up any of the leaked photos. I knew they were out there. A lot of people, you know, it was up to your own discretion on whether or not you wanted to check it out. And sure. I chose not to because I was like, those photos weren't meant to be out there. And, you know, I'm going to respect that. Under your rationale, if we're comparing the two, do we not look at these stories? Do we not read these emails? Is it kind of hard not to? Is the box already open?
It's impossible not to. But yeah. I mean, that's the point of the attack.
Right.
I mean, there are places that are going to publish this stuff regardless and are going to, you know, but I mean, there's a lot of weird, scary implications to this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Sony is not a small company. I'm going to guess their cybersecurity isn't like, I mean, the way that they're describing this and talking about this, I think that the actual attack is more interesting than the stuff coming out of it.
Right.
Because there are implications that are a lot bigger than whether Spider-Man is going back to Marvel or whatever. Or Ms. Pascal said that Angelina Jolie was a brat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's almost kind of like high schoolish to post it.
Right. I posted
there's something about it that's really just kind of like kind of immature and stupid about the whole thing.
Right. I mean as a joke, I posted on Twitter and on Facebook my reaction to all this stuff coming out after the fourth article I read about so and so said something about so and so. I posted the clip from Mean Girls when Regina George gets mad and makes the copies of all of the bad things everyone ever wrote in the burn book and then spreads it all over school to watch everyone tear each other apart.
I didn't know that that's what that was referring to.
And that's kind of what it's like. It's like, but that's sort of the thing is like, yeah, obviously it's a cheap move to put it all out there and to just destroy this industry, or specifically this company. But why was there a burn book in the first place?
It wasn't a burn book. Like, it was just private emails back and forth. Like, I mean, yes, I guess we say some weird, crazy crap, and maybe some people could take it out of context on the podcast. But no, I guess just at, you know, that level, you know, I think that if you're at that level and somebody releases, it doesn't matter who you are. I think somebody can kind of find something embarrassing about you.
Yeah.
Something that you would be uncomfortable with people sharing.
Well, and the internet is completely broken the physical limitations of self.
And privacy.
And privacy. But, I mean, you know, going back to the nude photos, going back to this, I feel like just by engaging in the internet, we are no longer limited to just an autonomous human being walking around allowed to share whatever information we feel comfortable at that moment. Once it's out there, it's out there, and you are now, you know, fragments of yourself are available to whoever, whenever.
And it's kind of permanent.
It is permanent. And
I mean, it might get buried, but it's there.
Right. And the more that we engage in social media, the more we engage in, you know, cell phone technologies, and we're, you know, tweeting and texting and all of this stuff. Dan Savage, he said a long time ago of like Anthony Weiner, who got in all that trouble about his dick pics.
Mm-hmm.
He said like this is our generation's I didn't inhale. Okay. Like in the future, every presidential candidate will have sent somebody dick pics in their life, because this it's getting to that point that this is just how we engage with people nowadays. And eventually, as a public, we're going to have to decide, like we've decided as a public, that we don't care if ex-presidents have smoked weed. Well, we're going to have to decide as a public that we don't care if they post nude photos
in
their teenage years or whatever.
Yeah, I want to say the president was Warren G. Harding. They found old love letters from mm-hmm. him. And I mean, this is the dude back in the, you know, 20s or teens.
Mm-hmm.
And he had like a name for his penis. And I mean, these were to his mistress in Detroit, and he was president at the time, and I mean, married dude. So, I mean, again, I mean, there's lots of questions about the internet. Have we always just been like this? And now it's just so up in your face? Or, right. I don't know, really.
Well, people always want to know what they were not supposed to know. That doesn't matter what the technology is. That's why tabloids exist.
Yeah, and and this feels really gossipy, the whole thing.
Sure, totally.
But
do you think that Sony as a company, once the dust is settled, and once they have their bearings again, and they've secured all their lines, do you think they're going to keep going the way they were, or do you think they're going to be a hell of a lot more careful about what they say to who?
Well, probably. I mean, I think...
And do you think that that's
a good
thing?
Lot of people are kind of feeling that kind of like... All of the companies have to feel that pressure because,
right.
again, nobody this came sideways. Nobody saw it at this level. You know, they thought, oh, maybe they might steal a couple of screeners or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but not the entire catalog, everything.
Right.
You know, and I mean, including, I mean, again, they are sending. Again, people are commenting on the gossip shit.
Right.
People aren't commenting on social security numbers being released.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
The or medical like records, those, yeah. that kind of stuff.
Or take the script for the next James Bond movie.
Yeah.
It was one of the things stolen. Like, I mean, these are actually kind of serious things. And there are people's livelihoods in the Sony company who are based on these things. And so when you ruin that company, you're not just ruining, you know... Like, I mean, yes, people are like, oh, yeah, we should really feel sorry for the CEO. It's not the CEO, you know, necessarily. But, I mean, I do feel bad for her just because she's a CEO and probably affluent and rich. That doesn't mean that she should be degraded like, mm-hmm. and whipped in the public square. It just all goes back to intention and how it was done and what was done.
Right.
And this is a crime.
Why it was done. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it eventually, why it was done is because somebody made a joke.
Mm. Because it's in retaliation of this movie.
Yeah, that right. I mean, that is the reasons.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, I'm okay. Obviously, they're going about it the wrong way. If this is, in fact, North Korea, which a lot of people think that it probably is, if that's the whole deal, they're allowed to protest whatever they want to protest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they don't like the movie, and... They have pretty good reasons for not liking it. Sure. They can, you know, they're allowed to come out and say, we don't think this is a good idea for a movie. We think this is, you know, a bullying and whatever. They can say all those things. The way they went about it, it's obviously, I don't know. I feel like both parties have something to learn from this. As far as that goes. I feel like we... You know, we put our big American pants on and we think, ha, 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 you know, we're indestructible and there's nothing that people can do say about us. And, you know, like, if you're going to make a movie that's that provocative, you probably should expect some pushback.
I see your point. I just don't think that the... it's like somebody makes fun of your dog, so right. you go and you murder their dog. It's kind of like the retaliation. You know, they go burn down your house,
right? I'm not saying
you said
that
they're because their curtains sucked.
I'm not saying that their method of retaliation is appropriate or even equal to what happened. But I am. I don't know. That's debatable. But I don't think so.
It's.
But wasn't the movie daring this?
No,
I mean essentially that's what they're saying is like, you know, by making this movie and then them, you know, initially coming out and saying we'd rather you not release this movie and that we are going to retaliate and then going whatever and releasing the movie anyway, that was essentially daring them to do whatever they were going to do. And I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of people thought like, oh, it's going to start World War III, and I don't think it's going to. They do plan on doing something worse on Christmas Day if it's released. I don't know what that means. If that just means that they're going to, like, you know, they have some internet scheme planned or what. But I don't know.
I guess I disagree with your sentiment. It's blatant and like, I mean, I don't know. Even if it's a bad joke and bad taste, this is the reaction is not warranted.
Okay.
So, I don't know.
Well, we got to move on now and get to our movie reviews.
Yeah, for real.
Because this is a movie podcast. And we're going to be talking about Exodus, Gods and Kings is the main review of the week. And I'll let you set that up.
Okay, so this is the Moses. This is about Moses.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Of the Bible.
Oh, yes, yes. Not Moses from down the block from you. no, so it's the Moses story about him, you know, getting kicked out of Egypt and then him coming back and plagues and such.
Sunday school classic, yes.
Yeah. So there's been a few movies put out about the subject. Yeah. So,
most famously, Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston.
Probably, yeah. I also was thinking about that little animated one.
Yeah, Prince of Egypt. That was produced by Spielberg. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's a thing. So it stars Christian Bale as that Moses guy. His brother is Ramses. He's from Egypt. He's the Pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of clash, and I don't know. This movie, I'm going to just straight up say, I don't know if my review can be trusted.
Interesting. Why?
The very first scene, John Turturro was in it. He's Ramsey's father.
Yeah.
And the first thing that came into my mind was, I am the Jesus. And like from then on, he was his character from The Big Lebowski. And it just kind of ruined the whole movie for me. Like, I don't know what you do when that happens as a reviewist. I try to be objective the whole time. That's what I'm seeing. And I'm putting this weird spin on everything. And it's just, I don't know. It was bad time. I mean, it was a big dumb Bible epic. Like, I mean, there's nothing. I mean, this seems like a pretty like middle of the road kind of Ridley Scott exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty.
Lots of production design.
Yeah, lots of production design. It was shot very well.
Mm-hmm.
Something I love about Ridley Scott is he always wants to say something in his movies, no matter what it's about.
Does he always?
I think so. Yeah, I really do. And in this film, I think he does, but he gives you so much more of this. Like, I just watched Kingdom of Heaven not too long ago.
Right. The cut. Oh, okay. I was going to say, yeah, the 3-hour cut or the 5-hour cut?
I think even the director's cut is only like 3.5 or something. Like
okay.
I don't think it's 5. I don't think it's ridiculous.
It's, I know they're both bad. Pretty long, but yeah.
It's pretty long, but. The thing is sometimes he doesn't. He gives you a lot of extra information,
mm-hmm.
and it's like this isn't the place you should start the story if this is what you want to talk about. Where the movie is actually gets kind of interesting is when Moses actually starts like talking with God.
Yes,
and you get this kind of almost antagonistical, not understanding. Sort of back and forth between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, sometimes you understand God, sometimes you think he's bad, sometimes you think he's good, sometimes, you know, you have a very strange, I mean, there's also, I mean, it also insinuates that, that maybe this was all just hallucination from him hitting his head a lot.
he does take quite a few spells early on in the movie.
Yeah. So is he just like a really like dumb football player almost that's hit his head too many times?
Mm. I'm gonna say probably not, given some of the things that happened in this movie. I think it's not trying to naturalize the Bible story as it's originally told. It's pretty much a straightforward.
Well, so you see these big moments, like these big
the plagues and
stuff like that.
The parting of the Red Sea.
But is that just a like interpretation of the people because of these like little attacks and stuff like that, or is it full blown God of Wrath stuff?
Hmm.
Like, I mean, is I mean, so I don't know. And I think he kind of hints at it a little bit, but. Again, I think that's what he's more interested in, is this relationship between these two characters.
Yeah.
And I don't think that he's really as much interested in, because it's you're told that, you know, it's about two brothers kind of arguing and Moses fighting Ramses and blah, blah, blah. And
right.
It doesn't really feel like it's that interested in that.
No.
Almost at all. And, yeah. Or even the most, it's not even the most interesting part of this movie. And if there is a subject matter, it's definitely not in that. So I feel like, again, Kingdom of Heaven, he also wanted to talk about God and man's relationship, or at least man's relationship to religion.
Mm-hmm.
And
you could argue that Prometheus is vaguely about that too.
Yeah, you for sure could.
Mm-hmm.
And, but the thing is in Kingdom of Heaven specifically in this movie, He adds so much superfluous stuff that you drowned in a giant wave of okay, stuff's happening.
Right. Good Exodus pun.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you. I'm tapping my nose the whole time you're talking. Almost on every point. Yes, I think that the movie is visually ambitious in a way that you
Did
can
you
always
think John Turturro was like Jesus?
Ridiculous. Ridiculous. Okay. I have to say, almost across the board, with the exception of Christian Bale, who I think is doing the best he can, this is one of the most distractingly miscast movies yep. I've seen in a long time. John Turturro was the first one that I just, yeah, it's giggle-inducing every time he's on screen. Ben Kingsley is just kind of doing the Ben Kingsley thing, and at this point it's like, yes, you're the bald, elderly, wise man character. That's what we can expect from you.
I even thought about his character in Iron Man 3.
Yeah.
like this just kept happening to me, so I didn't know if it was like, I'm just like,
Joel Edgerton looks like a drag queen with wig fell off the whole movie. Like, who plays Ramses? And Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad is just kind of like shifty-eyed and crazy and pretty much, I don't even know what he's doing in the movie, to be 100%.
I mean, bro.
Sigourney Weaver. The list goes on and on of this like distracting casting choices. You're like, what are you doing to me, movie? But if you look at it in the sense of this is just like a very, very, very traditional classical Hollywood Bible epic,
mm-hmm.
a biblical epic, you know, in this very Cecil B. DeMille kind of way. I think it pretty much fulfills in being that it is. It's very straightforward as far as its interpretation of the text of the biblical story. It's not like the Noah story, which is really taking it in a new direction or really interpreting it in a different way or having kind of this modern skeptical understanding of what happened. I think it's pretty much faithful, you know, if I'm allowed to use that word, to the source material, and is treating it as just, you know, script fodder as opposed to you know, actually saying something about the biblical implications of, you know, something, say, like, you know, the slaughter of thousands or slavery or genocide or all the other things you could talk about with this movie. It's not really interested in much of that. However, the big takeaway, I think, is what you've already stated, is this kind of barely thematic through line of the relationship between God and Moses, and what it is to have faith when it seems like, you know, the person you have faith in might not be of sound mind. You know, when you don't understand God, but he's telling you to do these things. And the interesting thing that this movie kind of realizes is that Moses, is not a lifelong Hebrew. No. He was skeptical of his own religion when he was Egyptian for most of his life, or, you know, the younger years of his life, I should say, and then converted, you know, midway through his adulthood. So when God starts talking to him and says, you're going to be the, you know, the leader of your people, these are people that he's just barely started to associate with, let alone taken on their entire religious ideology. So, yeah, it's a very conflicted relationship that he has with this God. And I don't mind the way that it's portrayed. I think some people are going to kind of... it's going to be make or break for some people how they decide to portray God. For some reason, I don't feel like giving it away, but...
yeah.
And I could see some people finding it just as campy as all of that, you know, crazy bronzer and eyeliner that's going on all throughout this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a drag queen show mixed with the 2012, the big... Ronald Emmerich, was that the guy?
Roland Emmerich, yeah.
Roland. Yeah. I mean, it's a disaster film for a lot of it.
Yeah.
It's if you want to see the Bible story, and it's kind of pretty.
If you want to see the Vegas, if you want to see the Vegas version of this story, this is the movie for you.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what this is, and you know what? I don't actually hate it for that. It is a little too long. You know, but that kind of comes with the territory, both with the Ridley Scott movie and with the biblical epic.
right.
it could probably be easily 20 to 40 minutes shorter. And there's a lot of just kind of brooding around that's not necessary for the script. The performances are all over the place. You can choose to enjoy them, as I did, or you can get annoyed really easily. That's very up to you. I think Christian Bale's actually doing it, though. I think he's pretty good in this movie.
Agreed.
That's about the only person I can say I enjoyed the performance for the right reason.
Well, but Joel Edgerton, I mean, I don't necessarily think he gave a bad performance.
No more than I can say that anybody in The Counselor was giving an intentionally bad performance.
I like that movie still.
I know you did.
I still like it. I still think it was better than people think.
I mean, this is a kind of a big, gaudy, monumental thing. You know, it's not a subtle or nuanced film. And even when it's really trying to do the thematics, like we've been talking about, it's buried under so much camp that it's kind of hard to go with it on a thematic, you know, substantive level.
Yeah. And maybe the thing with Joel Edgerton too, just because, like you said, he does look like a bald drag queen. maybe it's just, you know, a super white Australian dude just kind of looks funny in Egypt, because I mean that they did use makeup. Mm-hmm. They did do all of that, but
do we want to talk about the controversy?
What's the controversy?
The controversy is some people have said that this movie is whitewashing history. If you're talking about Bible stories, using the word history is kind of fluid anyway, to say the least. But some people are saying that, you know, why are these all British, American, you know, Australian actors? Why aren't we using actual, like, Middle Eastern or Mediterranean actors? Do you think that's a fair argument? Or do you think, like, if you're going in with that kind of, you know, concern for verisimilitude, then you shouldn't be walking into this movie anyway.
maybe. I don't know. I don't feel really passionate either way about it.
I don't either. And maybe it's because I knew the controversy going in, and I was already, like, in my head, I was like, whatever, it's Cecil B. DeMille, like, for the modern age. Like, you know,
right.
I don't care.
Well, and also, I mean... I don't know. Just for this film specifically, because I mean, it really, even that time period is so far removed.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't modern Egypt.
Yeah.
You know, it was very far removed from even that idea. So it's I mean, even time-wise, it's hard to, I mean, it wouldn't be a Middle Eastern act. I mean, it might be an Egyptian actor, but not, I mean, not Middle Eastern.
Right, but you know what I mean?
And like, Hebrews, like, specifically, too. But I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, if you're really going to be like that, you know, if you're really going to split the hair there, mm-hmm. like, you really got to be like, well, this is the full ramifications of that.
Yeah.
Like, what are we talking about? We can't even accurately, like, we can't even accurately say how this happened or if it happened or if anything about it is, like, true. So, I mean,
yeah.
What are we really talking about here? Like, so I don't know. With this film specifically, I was just like, eh, whatever.
Yeah.
She's still doing well. Charlton Heston.
But okay, so there's the movie. I don't know what kind of review that was. I don't know what people are supposed to get out of that.
No.
I think it's, if you go with the right people and you know what you're getting and you're up for it, there is fun to be had. You have to kind of like this type of movie, though.
In that way, I completely agree.
I can also see people getting really frustrated and bored by it.
Agreed. This isn't Gladiator.
No.
I guess from, like, I mean, for a religious person, I mean, if you like the Ten Commandments and you just want to see
I think really vague
Bible story, I guess.
I think,
I mean,
people...
it does. I don't think it really says much about belief or faith or anything, but
it tries to and then veers away from it almost at every turn. But
no, there is a really interesting movie in there, but it only does that really interesting movie for like 45 minutes.
Right, exactly. Of a very long movie. Yeah. Yeah, I actually think that the people, you know, the faithful,
yeah,
who are going to see the Bible story, who are going, you know, to relive their Sunday school years, are going to be pretty pleased with the order of events. Like I said, I don't think it's not challenging what we already know about the story.
No, it's pretty chronological if you're talking about the story.
Yeah, they don't set it in outer space or include rock monsters or anything like that.
But they should have.
You know, this movie actually could have done with some more rock monsters.
Well, I mean, I like the rock monsters in Noah, so I can't really say anything. But
I can't wait for their spinoff movie.
Noah versus
no
Moses.
Moses versus the rock monsters. All right, let's get into the Netflix homework. And I assigned this to you last week. The movie is called The Source Family. It's a documentary about a vegan hippie, possibly, arguably cult that took place around the early 70s in Los Angeles. And we actually got a voicemail from friend of the show, Keith Foster. He's been on the show before. He watched the movie and he wanted to kind of weigh in on it. So let's go ahead and listen to that.
Hello, I'm here to weigh in on the Netflix homework assignment, The Source Family, and what my thoughts on it were. So, I don't know. I felt like the name was a little on the nose. The Source Family obviously refers to the source of the Nazis' stolen gold during World War II. And this is sort of a more personal story that takes place much after the war. A Jewish family manages to track down, the Saltzman family manages to track down the possible whereabouts of their family's money, which they lost during the war. They hire a private investigator to go over to Europe and sort of track it down. And, you know, this seems like an exciting premise. Normally, I'm totally on board with anything that has the phrase lost Nazi gold in it. But I don't know. What should have been more Indiana Jones came across more like Philomena, but without any of the humor. So it led to just sort of a dreary 2.5 hours of nothing happening, you know, but elderly gentlemen talking about where this gold might have been hidden. And then it starts to get exciting in the third act. The last, you know, like half hour of the film is where most of the action takes place. But at that point, they couldn't really save the premise. It was as if they had totally lost track of, you know, this exciting Nazi thriller, and we're trying to go for this prestige thing about, you know, the effect of wartime on Jewish family, which, you know, I really wanted more of like a National Treasure kind of vibe out of this. And it was particularly confusing to me when Nicolas Cage showed up, like, at the very end to help the protagonist out. And, you know, at that point, it's just like, what is this movie even going for? Of course, there were a couple fun twists and turns along the way, particularly, again, with the Nicolas Cage character revealing that he was a Nazi war criminal who had somehow managed to stay alive, feeding off of the entombed gold of the Jews. But at this point, it felt a little late in the game to bring up such fantastical elements. So, you know, my review of The Source Family, which might differ from what Cassidy and Richard think, is I didn't really get a lot of the prestige I was supposed to get, and the thrills and chills were just a little too late in the game for me. It's about 2.5 hours of nothing and then some exciting moments at the end. So that's what I think.
All right.
That's not the movie I saw, but
I mean, I'm glad that he wanted to respond.
Do you think he's listening?
Do you think he just wanted to,
you know, respond?
Yeah. I mean, okay. Like, he didn't mention that it's a documentary.
Well, there's the whole thing about the Nazis and
the gold
families. Yeah, and gold.
What if he saw, maybe he saw another movie. Like, you know how sometimes on Netflix, like, you'll go to click on something and then you'll accidentally click on something else instead?
Well, or he saw, like, 4 movies and...
I just don't know.
Yeah, that was a little weird. Okay.
But thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the feedback. Or maybe not feedback, for your opinion, I guess.
Your opinion of whatever that was. Yeah. But the real movie that we're talking about this week, The Source Family, like I mentioned already, is a documentary. And... you would consider this sort of a big part of LA history, or a big part of LA's history in the subculture of sort of the free love hippie Aquarian movement. And it pretty much documents this crazy hippie cult that ran a vegan restaurant on Sunset Boulevard, I want to say. And
it was in California. It's on Sunset Strip.
Yeah, Sunset Strip in the early 70s, like mid 60s to the early 70s. And their father, who calls himself Father Yod, who was sort of independently wealthy, crazy man who had killed people with judo skills in the military before becoming this benevolent cult leader. And sort of, it talks, I want to say this,
he didn't kill them in the military, he killed them life.
Yeah,
he basically, he got in arguments about a girl and killed dudes, and then but he was still he was still in public, so I don't know.
Right,
anyway, they also talk about you also got to talk about the other criminal activities, about maybe he was rich because he was bank robbing,
possibly. I think we know just enough to know that this guy might not be on the level. But he regardless ends up growing this huge family, quote unquote, of these runaways and sort of free love hippie types who moved to LA to, you know, find religion or find themselves or whatever, and kind of becomes this this huge leader of this movement, and they make rock records, and, you know, they get, you know, moved around all over LA, and eventually have to move to Hawaii. And I think the cool thing about this documentary is that all of the key interviews are with ex family members.
Right.
And so there's a big part of this whole, the kind of subtext here is we all know that these people existed. You know, we've seen all the videos, we've seen all the footage of, like, you know, these types of people or people who've lived in cults or, you know, these kind of flash in the pan religions that kind of came and went in the, during this time. But we never really talk about it anymore, even though a lot of these people still have to exist and still carry day jobs nowadays. You know, what are these people like now? And I think that's kind of what the movie's sort of getting at. While telling this history.
I think it's telling the history, and I think it's... maybe it's just the mirror factor, but I think it's a little subversive, and it's kind of going into the whole religious leader types.
Mm-hmm.
What they can, or probably... Maybe he has some parallels to Moses. Hit his head a couple times in the military.
Yeah.
That's what I got more from it, mm-hmm. was kind of how religions form. But for sure, even though it's disbanded,
mm-hmm.
this specifically, even this religion or cult or whatever you want to refer to it as, was really influential and still really influential. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole health food scene was kind of born out of it
in a big way.
And to say that that's not a multi-million, if not billion-dollar industry in the U.S. right now.
Yeah.
And some of the ex-members are parts of that. Mm-hmm. Some of the ex-members are big parts of the, you know, of, like computer kind of hardware kind of scene, like computer chips and software and stuff like that. And to think about Steve Jobs and his kind of aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, when you think about kind of the influence, you know, kind of left over by it, it's all very interesting to think about belief and systems and all that kind of stuff in that kind of way.
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I think also what this movie, I think, really provides really well is just a big host of great interview subjects,
mm-hmm.
and great anecdotal, you know, storytelling of, you know, the crazy stuff they, you know, Father Yod decided was law one day, then the next day would decide against it, and, you know, eventually became the husband of like 16 wives, you know, and, how they would play at high school, the, you know, his band, his crazy psychedelic band, would play at high schools in UCLA to get new members, and just all the strange tentacles he had out there all throughout LA at the time.
Well, I mean, he had Steve McQueen would eat at his restaurant, and he was friends with a bunch of stars, and maybe when he went down full crazy lane, they weren't as friendly with him, but because you're a public figure and people will judge you harshly, mm-hmm. or be friends with crazy people. But very interesting. And I agree with the interview technique, and I mean, how it's edited is obviously interesting. And also when you get into some of, like, again, and like you said, like some of the aftermath, mm-hmm. where these people ended up and how they ended up and stuff like that was very, very interesting. Also, kind of people's, like, what it did to different people. You know, some people it deeply, deeply affected for the rest of their life and kind of ruined them.
Yeah.
Some people just kind of moved on. Some people kind of did it and then just never thought about it again. I mean, the different reactions to what it can do to someone is.
And some people still look at it as a very positive experience, even though they maybe don't follow the belief system anymore. They maybe don't even, you know, continue with veganism. They still see it as like they learned something from that time about themselves or about society or about religion or spirituality.
Yeah.
And sort of what does that mean ultimately? That, you know, what is the sole purpose of following a practice? Maybe it's not just simply about believing, but it's more about the act of belief and what that does to you in your personal life and what that does to your personality.
Yeah. And it's interesting and provocative. And it really does elicit some kind of deep thought about that, about belief systems. So
we should also say that all of these people were high as fuck the whole time.
That is true.
So when they're talking about like all these crazy astral planes that they've seen and all these miracles they've witnessed and all this stuff, you have to wonder, yeah, but how was your state of mind at the time?
Yeah, but I mean, even I mean, but they even talked about maybe later it changed. They didn't really go into that a lot. If like, but when I mean, smoking 1 6-second inhalation of marijuana wouldn't get you that high. If they continued with that practice,
I'm willing to bet that that was probably not the only weed they were smoking the whole time, or whatever else they were doing.
I agree, but just if they followed it, I was just kind of like, oh, that wouldn't make you that high. So I guess, but I mean, humans again, it depends on, you know, what system you're operating in on and what you're kind of believing and putting out there. So, humans in general, if you believe in something, you know, whatever you want to believe can exist as a human,
right?
Like, truly.
We create patterns in our minds. That's where we're a rational thinking species, and we want to create meaning where it might not even exist. And I think for a lot of people, I think actually one of the most interesting things that was said about this documentary was that a lot of these people, this generation, this kind of post-war generation, we now call it baby boomers, they all lived in these kind of, they came from a generation where fathers were not very present, you know, even if they were actually there, a lot of times they were working almost all the time, or they were just not very close, or affection was kind of not seen as socially normal. So they were raised
assholes.
Yeah, they were raised really with hard-nosed kind of father figures, and here's this benevolent guy espousing like, I love you as is. And yeah, you know, we can actually trace the sort of growth of the spiritual movement, and not just crazy wackadoo cults like this, but the spiritual movement in general, a certain breed of neoconservative Christianity, and a lot of other kind of megachurch stuff that we see now, kind of comes from the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the early 70s.
Interesting, yeah.
From this whole generation that had shitty fathers.
There's a lot of implications of the film. The film is, again, it is, it elicits, and you become, you know, you start imbuing it with, I think actually in form, it's just a good mirror.
Mm-hmm.
It just sets you up and shows you a lot of things and gets you thinking about it. And it's just, it's good, and it's well done. It's a very interesting documentary, and, yeah, I think I just pretty much recommend it.
Yeah, me too. I think it's an interesting look at history. It's asking a lot of questions, but it's also really entertaining. It's really funny.
It is entertaining and funny and fun, and yeah, agreed.
Yeah,
I mean that wasn't.
I totally
no John Turturro moments.
No, well, maybe a couple. What is the Netflix homework that you wanted to assign me next week?
It's an older classic movie that neither of us have seen. That movie is Panic at Needle Park. So I've always heard good things. I think this is one of those things that catapulted Al Pacino as an actor too. So
yeah, one of his earliest performances, I think. And if anyone wants to weigh in on that or any of the movies we talked about this week, I mean, what? Trying to think about what could have happened with that review.
Maybe he was.
Maybe he had a 6-second inhalation.
An astral plane something. Experience.
I don't know.
Maybe a stroke in the middle.
But if you want to respond, we do encourage it, and I guess we'll play it anyway. At jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. And if you want to send a voicemail like he did, he's just sent an MP3 file or a wave if you have a way of recording yourself. You can do that if you don't want to type something out, but we'll also read anything you send us. You can also find us on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/jabberpodcast, or on Twitter @jabberpodcast, all one word. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio or the Zune and Windows podcast app. We are all over the place there. You can read the movie reviews that I do every week for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. Took a break last week for finals, but I allow myself one every once in a while.
Yeah, that's good.
You can also read the stuff I do for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. You can read Richard's blog at rdwally.weebly.com. And you can check out Brad and Amanda and Alyssa over at Quarter Life Crisis. They're finishing up the Nov Down series they've been doing, their multi-segmented write-a-thon. And that's been fun to listen to, and I'm interested to hear how those wrap up their stories.
Was that part of, like, Nana?
Nanny Rima. It was kind of, yeah, that was sort of the kickoff point, but I think they're actually going to keep this segment, this bi-weekly thing, going for the whole podcast now. Because it's been getting a lot of reaction, which is good. Speaking of reaction, that episode of the Reaction Podcast that I did, the interview, it is out now. It was actually posted on the 2nd of December. And I think a lot of Reaction Podcast listeners came over to check out Jabber and the Drone, because one of our last episodes, one of our highest viewed yet. So thank you, Reaction Podcast listeners, if you're still listening. And thank you to the Reaction Podcast for having me on. And be sure to listen to Leland's podcast over in Olympia, Washington, Dampercast. And until next week, we will talk to you.
Yes?
Should I try that again?
Yeah, maybe try that one again.
Do another take?
Yeah.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Bye.
Talk to you next week. Bye.